You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Hey everybody, welcome to Inside the Locker. We've been off a few months watching the world burn, playing the fiddle on the sidelines. We missed a lot. JC was like, hey, let's do a Chicago Cubs World Series podcast. And we were all just like, no, fuck that.
It's like, what could happen if we don't do a Cubs podcast? Nothing bad could happen.
What's the worst that could happen?
And the Cubs won the World Series.
Fuck yeah, they did.
Which, you know, I don't have a bad thing to say about that. That's pretty cool. We're happy for JC. We're happy for Cubs fans. We're happy for Indians fans who got a great series out of it.
Yeah.
Let me introduce the squad here. On the boards, Logan Urey.
Yo.
Elliot Fontenette sitting next to me with a tucked-in polo shirt.
Sorry.
Looking good. Looking business cash.
looking very lawyerly.
Yeah, exactly.
Very lawyerly. He's...
looking like I had to do contract negotiations today.
Oh.
The
worst kind of negotiation.
It was horrible.
And to my far left, JC De Leon is in the house. JC, what's going on, man?
Not a lot.
So we got a lot to talk about. You know, we're going to sort of keep this one free-formed. We're going to try to do more podcasts going into the home stretch. You know, what always bugs me as a consumer is that when you get into the holiday season, all of your favorite shows go away.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're in, like, this podcast. You're like, oh, man, I have to spend all the holiday. I have to drive to my parents' house. And, my favorite podcast doesn't have a new episode. So we're going to try and be more consistent for the rest of the year and get you through that holiday season. We're going to have some fun. First thing I want to do tonight, just because I'm curious. So JC saw the film Arrival recently.
I did.
Starring...
I did, too. It was really good.
Amy
Adams and Jeremy Renner.
And Forest Whitaker.
Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do for you here is I just want them to tell me, like, what happens in the movie. And just
spoil it right
just
off the bat?
Yeah, because, like, so in the trailer, a bunch of eggs land, and then...
They're called shells.
They're called shells?
They're called shells.
They call them shells in the movie.
They do?
Yeah.
Huh. And then Amy Adams, I think, has to like, translate stuff and make contact. So what happens from there? Just tell me.
So Jodie Foster... No.
Spoiler. But actually, you know, giving spoilers for this movie is actually, like, the most appropriate and accurate way to describe this movie, actually. So it sort of works.
So yeah. What are we doing? We're going to spoil this movie.
Yeah. It doesn't need to be spoiled, but, I mean, the trailers do make it seem like it's a different take on a movie like Independence Day. And I do feel like it's a much smarter movie than that. Like, I walked out of that
course,
movie.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, I walked out of that movie... being a fan of the original Independence Day, not so much the sequel, but it's just like, man, those big, dumb action science movies are really dumb, and this movie's super smart and very dramatic and, like, hits you emotionally, and, well, yeah.
So what happens?
It's like serious science fiction in the sense of, like, there's science to it. Or there's actually not that much.
You know, it does what the best science fiction does, is it uses science fiction to tell us something about ourselves.
Yeah.
Guys, that's great. What happens in this movie?
You really want to know?
I don't care. Yes, I
okay,
want to know.
Fine.
All right, so now we're going to lose the three listeners that we have.
Well, I mean, look, I'm not going to spoil the big thing, but I will...
Yes, you are.
Okay, so aliens come down. One of the things Arrival does that's really cool is...
Oh, hold on. So what we're going to do is we're going to call this TLDR. Right. And there's a new segment I just made up. It's called TLDR. For those of you who aren't up on hip internet speak, TLDR stands for Too Long, Didn't Read... And it's like when you don't have time to see this movie, don't have time to consume this media, but you just want to know what's up. So we're going to call this TLDR, and for the next...
Hey, if you don't want The Arrival spoiled for you, go ahead and skip ahead on your podcast to around 9 minutes and 50 seconds. Thanks.
We're going to discuss the plot of this movie, so if you don't want to know, just skip ahead 2 minutes exactly. I'm going to time it. I'm pulling up my timer right now. Got my iPhone 6 right here in front of me. I'm going to set the clock, okay? So... for the next 2 minutes, tell me what happens.
I think we can actually tell you what happens without actually spoiling the big twist.
No, I want you to tell me the plot of this movie.
Okay, fine. So aliens come to Earth, obviously, and the government starts freaking out. There are 12 ships across the world. The government say, well, we have to figure out why they're here, what they want. And the best way to figure that out is to, you know, send a linguist up there that can figure out what language they speak.
Mm-hmm. That they can speak to them, talk to them.
And so they go looking for the best linguist They find Amy Adams. She gets flown there. She meets Jeremy Renner, who's a theoretical physicist. They go up. They're with a bunch of other army dudes. They are there to try to make contact, but the aliens, being alien, don't speak anything that's really easily discernible.
Sure.
So the entire movie is about her understanding their language.
Okay.
But their language...
Or learning their language.
No, yeah. I say understanding.
Okay, yeah.
Because, and that's an important distinction. I'm being a dick, but that's an important distinction because their language is not just speaking or writing. It is how they perceive time and how they experience the world. So they are imparting on Amy Adams an ability to perceive time non-linearly.
Mm-hmm.
And they use that as a way to say, look, you now have this... They call it a weapon... They say weapon because they're not translating right, but it's a tool because they need our help in 3,000 years. But for them, 3,000 years is like tomorrow.
Mm.
So, but for us, since we don't view time that way, we still view it linearly. Like, you spend the entire movie watching it and not realizing that the movie is showing you as she's going through the movie, her learning to speak their language subconsciously.
Mm.
And the movie goes through it and does all these cutaways that you think are just to reestablish the plot. But are actually showing you how she's learning their language. When she learns their language, everything's cool. Everything turns out good, and everybody's happy, and we're good.
I think that's a
in
pretty,
time.
That's a good summation of it, and it's still worth watching.
And
even,
I still preserve the twist.
Doing that, you did.
Okay, so we're gonna do another 30 seconds. Elliot, for those of you that skipped ahead and came back, Elliot told us what happened, but didn't tell me the twist. So we're gonna skip ahead 1 minute. If you don't want to know the twist, then I want to know the twist. So, and here we go.
Time. Okay, well, you learn that through her perception of time, she figures out like
you have to present it in this way. Like, if throughout the entire movie you see this kind of like
you think they're flashbacks.
They seem to be flashbacks of her with her daughter, and you kind of see through these flashbacks the perception of her daughter growing up, you know, being a child and good memories and all that stuff, and eventually whenever she's a teenager she ends up getting some sort of cancer, probably like leukemia,
a rare
like
form,
and ends up dying as a teenager. So Amy Adams has a daughter that dies at a young age, but
you figure out that Jeremy Renner is actually the husband and the father, and he leaves her because she knows before the kid's born, because of her perception of time, that that kid will die, but chooses to have the kid anyway. Because Arrival's making a statement that even if something's going to be bad, it's better to have the good memories than to avoid the bad memories just because you don't want to have them eventually. Because they are a part of life. They're always, the bad is always going to come, but the good doesn't always have to come.
And time. So that's it. There's no more twists in the movie.
That is the twist.
That's it.
The very satisfying twist that you ruined. That's such a satisfying movie to watch, dude.
It was a very good movie, and it was well presented, and it's totally worth watching.
But exactly. So my point with movie and cinema is that, like, if what you're selling me is a twist or we won't believe what happens next,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to see the movie. I want to see the movie movies are experiential. You want to watch it. You want to take it in. Plot doesn't matter, you guys. What matters is the experience. And if all you have is the suspense of... That's why Breaking Bad doesn't hold up
well. The thing about this movie is movie doesn't advertise that there is a twist.
And the twist is actually built into the plot, not in a cheap way. The entire movie justifies the twist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not a Shyamalan movie.
It's not hinting at a twist the entire time.
It comes out of nowhere.
Yeah. You're suddenly like, oh, well, this totally changes everything I was expecting.
Yeah,
the
twist changes how you think about the theme of the movie, because you're thinking the theme is recovering from heartache and going forward, and the theme is no. It's saying, I know heartache's going to be there, but I don't give a shit because I want the good stuff too.
So Jesus, we're going to have to cut.
Wait, hold on. So the aliens in 3,000 years turn out to be okay.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things about this movie is it goes, you know, if aliens have the power to come to our world, why the fuck would they be dicks? They don't need anything we got. Like, they're just coming to be like, hey, dudes, we might need your help in a little bit. You can have all this technology.
Yeah, so get your shit together.
Get your shit together, people. Stop fighting amongst each other. This is, like, stupid as shit, people. Don't elect Trump. What, you elected Trump, fine. Just don't let him near the nuclear... Okay, you let him near the nuclear codes. Okay, you're not going to impeach him. Well, fuck.
Okay, so there you go. That concludes our discussion of the movie Arrival, which I guess was more of, like, you guys telling me what happens.
That's what you asked for!
I'm happy to know. And I hope you learned something. All right, I guess we should talk about the Chicago Cubs for like 2 minutes, just because what happened was so historic that we'd be remiss if we didn't, you know, really like spend some time dissecting it. So
especially just fucking Game Seven.
Yeah, yeah.
Game Seven.
The manager almost lost for them.
Well, so JC, I want you to, as the Chicago Cubs fan in the room, why don't you take us through your the roller coaster of emotions that was, you know, the fifth inning onward in that epic, wild, sloppy, beautiful, historic game.
So I'm just going to pull up your Twitter feed.
Yeah, it's it was the most harrowing sports viewing experience I've ever had in my life. Like, I, as much as I love sports and as much as I, you know, love basketball and everything like that, even when the Warriors were going through their finals run in which they beat, the Cavs are going through their finals run in which they beat the Warriors, I never lived basket to basket the way I did pitch by pitch. Like, this, what I was doing was holding my breath every pitch, literally. And as soon as whatever happened happened, I would exhale, I would sit back on my couch, and then I would just get ready for the next pitch. I was doing that the entire game. And my big thing with baseball, what I've always said, is the romanticism of it. I believe, you know, in karmic retribution and things like that in baseball. And so there were things that comforted me throughout that evening. Like, you know, yeah, from the fifth inning on, they bring in John Lester when he shouldn't have, because Kyle Hendricks was dealing. And John Lester gives up that wild pitch that scores two runs. That's catastrophic. But then you got David Ross hitting that, being the oldest person to ever hit a home run in the World Series. And I'm like, that's a great sign. Like, how are the baseball guys going to waste this moment? Like, the only reason David Ross is in the game is because he's the only catcher who catches John Lester. And so things like that. But then Aroldis Chapman comes in the game, gives up that two-run blast to tie.
And immediately Joe Buck mentions the domestic abuse thing.
Yeah.
Immediately makes him a bad guy.
And
honestly, he made himself a bad guy.
Honestly, there were a number of Cubs fans. Honestly, there were a number of Cubs fans throughout the year that were kind of dreading this moment. Like, we didn't want our World Series hopes to be pinned on this legitimately bad guy. And here we are, Game 7, with the lead, relying on this guy, and he blows it. And we just think that, and I just thought, that's it. This is how it ends. This is...
It's funny you mention that, because, like, I never for a second thought the Cubs were going to lose. And I was like, the Cleveland Indians are going to come back, and they're gonna have this really wonderful last-minute surge. We're going to go to extra innings, and the Cubs are going to win in the most dramatic way possible. I really believe that. I texted that to my father-in-law, who's a big Cubs fan, like, and he just texted me back one word. He was like, yep. Like, I really thought the game was so exciting, but as someone who was distant from it, I was just like, oh, man, I think the Cubs are going to win. Like, you felt, you really, really felt.
There's a momentum you can
the
feel.
Momentum. The Cubs are not going to leave this field without winning this game.
Because of the epic moments and things like that that I mentioned, the David Ross home run, the leadoff home run to start the game, even throughout the playoff run, there were just these little moments. And I'm just like, this is a team of destiny. Like, this is the year. Like, when you see in one of the earlier playoffs games, a blooper go right through the shortstop, right to Chris Bryant, into the left fielder's hands. And then he ends up throwing the guy out at home. Like, those are, like, moments like that all throughout the series. The Miguel Montero Grand Slam and the NLCS. Things like that. It was just like, that's why I feel like this is a year. But I couldn't help but still be on the edge of my seat every pitch.
Can I cut in? And I'm going to read to the listeners from JC's Twitter feed from right before the end of the game. One inning at a time. Baez! It's Game 7. They can't keep tossing stars out there before Chapman. Grandpa Ross! I'm still too nervous to start counting. Yep, I know Jake can go 20 pitches, still got Strop. Adroz has pitches left. Well, that wasn't ideal. Fuck. Got him. I'm soaked in sweat. Stomach nervous. Son of a bitch bastard. All one word. Motherfuck. They're not going to. It's their destiny. Me and every Cubs fan will die without ever witnessing them win it.
Yep.
And then just a whole bunch of bears were posted. The greatest sports year of my life. Cannot believe it. I have no words. LeBron won the way he did. Teams I've rooted for have won championships. I've never had tears in my eyes till now.
It's the first time I've ever, like, legitimately teared up. It's the first time I've ever, me and my sister hopped on the website and bought championship gear.
Nice.
How do I sleep tonight? I have no idea what to do.
I didn't. I didn't go to sleep that night till 3 a.m. because I just kept watching, you know, the live feeds from the streets of Chicago. The Bill Murray interview.
Mm-hmm. It was the same thing for me in election night.
Yeah. I'm going to strangle you. That's going to happen.
The Bill Murray interview, and it was kind of poetic because he was fine and composed all throughout the interview, and then at one point,
what a poor downtrodden guy. He hasn't had any luck in life.
Well, he starts talking about his mom who had passed away. I forgot how many years, but on the anniversary of when Game 7 was. Mm-hmm. And then he mentioned the fans, and then almost on cue, the fans started singing Go Cubs Go, and every time, all night, just kept hearing Go Cubs Go, would just bring that feeling back again, and it was just like, it was the most surreal experience. Like, I still don't even really know how to describe it, it felt that good, but it did kind of make me sort of look back in some perspective on how I perceive sports, and you know, from now on, I probably won't take things as seriously. Like, I don't... With the Cubs, I was always worried about jinxing them. I never really wore Cubs gear because I'm not from Chicago, and I thought maybe I shouldn't, like, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But no, that's all out the window. Now I've got Cubs gear. I'm going to buy a Cubs jersey.
That's good. It's kind of that stuff where there can be a fine line between a bandwagon fan and someone who has learned to love a team,
because of
success or because of a potential failure. Yeah.
And then, you know, the Cubs are one of those teams that they're such an iconic franchise. They've been lionized in film, big ass city. Even when they were lovable losers, they still had their own cable TV network. You know, they were still on WGN all the time.
Oh my, yeah, right.
So
everyone watched them.
So, you know, I think though, like, what's amazing about the Cubs story is, like, it's such a big fucking franchise with so much success where you're like, how is this team not have one World Series title? And it just felt overdue, and it was pretty amazing. I don't have a bad word to say about it. I've been to Wrigleyville.
I do.
Go ahead.
It caused Trump to win. There's too much good.
It didn't. It had.
There's an equilibrium of good in this world, and that upset the fucking balance.
I want to argue that, but I have no retort.
It happened in the Midwest. A bunch of people were too happy.
I did some of my other irrational reactions to Cubs things of the past, like when they didn't win last year in 2015, I said I would never watch Back to the Future 2 again.
Oh.
And I haven't, and I'm glad I can go back and watch that movie now.
Yeah.
When they lost Game 1 of the World Series, I was like, that's it. Major League sucks. I'm never watching that movie again. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And so I'm glad I can watch that and appreciate that.
How do you feel about being like, you know, because like North Shore, that's like the rich part of Chicago. Like,
the White Sox versus Cubs thing.
Yeah.
I felt bad for the White Sox in 2005 when they won the World Series and nobody in Chicago gave a shit.
Yeah. Because it's all the brothers that won. Not the money.
Yeah, I don't know. I enjoy watching the Cubs win because, number one, the drought, but also because I've seen them forever.
Yeah, know? And just that celebration. Like, it was the largest gathering of humans in the U.S. in history. 5 million people all gathered together to celebrate what had happened.
Yeah.
Not an unhappy person in the entire 5 million. Like, unless something you're from that Cleveland. The world really needed.
I like that Obama stayed true to. He didn't pump up the Cubs, but he brought Bill Murray in to do, like, the press briefing. He's like, look, I'm a White Sox fan.
Yeah.
Let's get this other guy to say something good about the Cubs.
Yes. And, I mean, I did see a number of White Sox fans, you know, say they were happy for the Cubs and they were happy for the city. And
yeah. I think you have to be a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when the NLCS started, I was hanging out with a friend of mine who's, like, a big metal head. And he was like, I was like, hey, man, so this Cubs thing's happening. Man, are you into it? He's like, bro, I've been to Wrigleyville. Those people don't deserve anything. And, you know, there is kind of like a Jersey Shore vibe in the Wrigleyville bars, but it's pretty. It's pretty chill. I love Chicago. Chicago is one of the most tragic cities because it's so segregated. Like, it's so segregated
by design.
And it's a big salad bar, and yeah, like, it's hard to just sit there and watch, like, people in Wrigley celebrating a game where you're like, all of these people are people who can afford to go to the World Series, and like just across the road, there's, you know, kids getting shot in the corner. Like, it felt kind of trivial early on, but as the game like kept going, I just enjoy the hell out of it. I think it's just such a fun, good team, good manager, iconic players, and you know, I think we're all glad it happened.
I mean, I was going for the Cubs. It's just, it's hard to divorce sports sometimes for what they symbolize, because when you got a world-class city in Chicago, like, I've only been there once, but it's sure. it's a world-class city. It's America's second city, because L.A. is not. It's New York, Chicago, L.A., maybe fucking Dallas is four. But, like...
Yeah, San Francisco's in there, too.
Bunch of tech assholes. Oh, I'm saying that. Okay. I've watched Silicon Valley. Yeah. But, you know, you look at Chicago and their franchises, and it mirrors their city. Because you got Chicago Cubs, and you got the White Sox. And, like, Chicago, you know, the thing that bothered me when I was watching a bunch of this is, like, ESPN's acting like, oh, the Chicago fans, they finally have something to hold on to. Wait, well, what? You had the Bulls.
The Blackhawks.
You had the Bears. And you had the White Sox. You're doing fine, okay? Let's just calm this shit down. You're not New Orleans with the Saints, okay? Let's just dial this back a little bit.
Chicago
Cubs. I'm just being salty so far.
Hey, no, but again, that thing needed to happen, and that game was just epic and wonderful. And the funny thing is, I fell asleep three times during the game. Because at the end of the day,
it's because it's baseball.
It's still a long ass. It's baseball. I love baseball, but it's still a long ass baseball game. But I didn't turn off the TV for a second. I was just like, I have to watch this whole game.
Yeah, it's just that sport when you're invested, like every pitch, like it's there's no sport like it in the playoffs. It's crazy.
No, I think baseball might benefit from a shorter regular season, because it's like there's no reason for me to watch. It's like you're racing for a pennant. Okay.
Well, okay, look, but we can't. You know, baseball tradition is what baseball runs on, so you can't change the season, because then you're going to change the record books, and it's going to change everything. You can't. Baseball is baseball. It's a great, cool, fun sport. A lot of continuity. I love that there's like real history there. I love the idea of like thinking about the New York Mets playing the Kansas City Royals in 100 years. You know, like that's pretty cool. And now let's talk about another sport. Why don't we talk about? What do you guys want to talk about?
I do a college football round.
Hockey.
Hockey. All right, guys, we're gonna do a little blow by blow hockey preview. We're going to start with the Phoenix Coyotes, and then we're going to go. I don't think they exist anymore. I like how hockey failed in the United States, and then they all just went back to Canada. And like the Winnipeg Jets used to be the fucking, you know who the fuck knows.
I don't think it failed in the U.S. I think the NHL is still the most profitable like hockey division, hockey league in the world.
If we have to debate whether it failed, it failed.
Well, I guess it aimed for this mainstream Saturday morning cartoon thing in the 80s and 90s.
It did.
And it didn't quite get there. And so now it's like, okay, well, okay, but we're hockey though. Hockey. And so if you're like hanging out in DC or New York, you know, there'll be some guy at the sports bar who's like, I like manly sports like hockey, not like these diva athletes. And you're like, all right, man.
Like, you just like watching white people play sports.
You like watching a guy who's as tall as you. I get it. That's fine. I'm not mad at that. That's why I like watching Mexican soccer players, because I'm like, oh, man, they all look like me. They're all like as tall as I am.
But why do you think NASCAR is a thing? It's like, oh, we just want something that's for us.
I love NASCAR, man. Who doesn't? How do you not love NASCAR?
Who's in the chase right now?
You got Jeff Johnson. You have
just turn left. There we go. Okay, I'm turning left.
No, it's a hard sport. You got
shake and bake.
As a fan of motorsport, particularly F1, I can appreciate NASCAR, but it's not necessarily as interesting to me as the
other. I just don't think it's a sport.
Oh, it's a sport.
It doesn't. It's so, not a sport.
It legitimately takes a tremendous amount of athleticism to handle those machines.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
I think it's a competition. I think it's a completely valid competition. But when you talk about pushing your body, like,
So they do.
Yeah, it takes strength to handle the car at that speed.
It takes nerves. It takes like this nerve.
The inside of the cabins get extremely hot.
Yeah, like the half of the drivers in Formula One are regular marathon runners.
By this logic, Vin Diesel's character in Fast and the Furious is an athlete.
Have you seen his muscle?
No, because he drives short distances.
Yeah.
To be able to drive that
he's
long,
a drag.
Okay, so
keep your focus
so
for that
long. The dividing line is the endurance required makes you an athlete. Not so if you're a short distance drag racer, you're not an athlete.
I guarantee you that.
Hey, you know I'm just taking the piss right now, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You
have me defending NASCAR, and it's making me mad. Because I don't like NASCAR.
Okay,
I'm indifferent to it.
We can get off this
topic. We can proceed amicably. Yeah. I'm down with NASCAR. I like that it exists. I used to edit a bunch of NASCAR sports stories for a sports blog, and I enjoyed them. Hey, let's talk college football, guys. All right.
Holy shit, I just saw the score. We're currently watching the Houston versus Louisville game.
It's pronounced Louisville.
Oh.
Louisville.
I said Louisville.
Thank you, Kristen Dunst from Elizabethtown.
I've never seen that movie. And I don't know why you saw that movie.
Because it's Cameron Crowe.
I love
the Cameron Crowe movies.
You love... So you heard it here for our first, folks. Elliot Fonn, that big Elizabethtown fan.
Damn right.
It's his favorite rom-com.
Yeah.
If you look at his Facebook profile under likes, it's like Orlando Bloom anything.
It's Elizabethtown. Yeah.
Hey, so, let's talk college football for a second. All right, so LSU, doesn't matter.
Does not matter this year.
Although,
RIP Les Miles.
A pretty good team. Texas doesn't really matter this year, although a pretty bad team. Texas A&M, you guys were fourth place for a solid week. Did not work out. So... Now you have to play the national game, right? Let's talk about the national game. Well, here's what you can look forward to during the Thanksgiving break. Well, you got the Apple Cup, Washington State. That rivalry is back.
Mike Leach, man, makes everything magical.
Yeah, he makes everything interesting. So the Apple Cup is going to be awesome. You have a lot of teams. I mean, I don't know. I think it's hard because this year it's Nebraska. It's everybody else. Everyone knows
Nebraska
or Alabama.
Yeah, it's like might have to just end the season now.
My bad.
It's like Alabama's going to win the championship.
Alabama's going
to
win.
That was kind of my most disappointing last weekend. It sort of seemed to sum up the season in a nutshell for me. You had 2, 3, and 4 all lose in the same weekend, mm-hmm. and then Alabama dropping a 50 burger on whoever it is they dropped it on.
And I'm not saying LSU was good this year, but I feel like LSU played Alabama the closest,
sure,
of any of their opponents, and even this, like they just. Alabama just fucking wears you down. Well, you're just like, well, shit.
Alabama has depth and talent, and it has what you don't see in the Big Ten, which is the best athletes are on the field were recruited to play defense. And it's just too much for most teams to handle to really, really have a real chance at winning. And now you have a pretty cool, unique, inventive offense. You have Steve Sarkisian and Lane Kiffin, kind of like two guys that are qualified to run their own program, kind of playing battleship with the new offense. So who can match up with Alabama? Well, Ohio State can, but is Ohio State going to get into the Final Four? Probably not, because if you don't already know this, they're going to be able to win out. And if they win out, that means that Penn State's going to play Wisconsin for the Big Ten title game. The winner of that game goes to the Final Four. So you're going to have potentially Penn State play Alabama in a 1-4 matchup, which will be ugly.
Yes! Which is what Penn State deserves.
Which is what Penn State deserves. And then you have Clemson, which will probably win out and make it. And then you have...
Michigan?
Michigan's going to be out because they would theoretically lose to Ohio State.
That's right.
So you could throw in Ohio State in there and Penn State and Alabama. That would leave out Clemson and Washington and potentially a one-loss West Virginia, one-loss Oklahoma. So it's a mess. Going to be contentious. No one's going to be happy with the result. It won't really be fair.
It's college football.
It's college football, baby. That's what it is. Now,
that's why we need 8 teams.
Obama tried to fix it.
It's
gone.
Obama got us a playoff, right? So that's nice.
Obama.
It's a step towards a real playoff. It's still better than the BCS.
It is almost better than the BCS. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'd rather have a computer than a team of people arguing in a room and they all have, like, a special interest.
I've certainly heard arguments for combining the BCS with the playoff system. So you take the BCS rankings. Instead of 1 and 2, then you take the top four or eight, potentially.
I just
and then combine those two together. See, you mix everything together.
See, I just think you go 18 playoff, but no automatic bids. Like, I don't believe in this, like, well, we got to have a representative. Fuck you. If your conference sucks, you shouldn't have a rep there. Like, well, it should be just, who's the best?
Okay. It is weird, though, that, like...
But if you lost your championship game, you don't get to go.
Yeah, it is weird that, like, sports in general are beginning to look more towards analytics and, like, you know, mathematical models to determine success and things like that, like, right after the BCS abandoned its computer system, which people seem to have problems with. But, I mean, you know, the analytical model...
College football is a sport played by 18- and 22-year-olds.
Yeah.
Moreover, an 18-year-old in August is different from an 18-year-old in December.
That's true.
What you're seeing is number 5 Louisville right now losing 31-0 almost at halftime at the University of Houston, a team that came into the season without, you know, being given much of a puncher's chance to be successful.
It's the second time this season. Earlier I thought, I was like, man, I should put money on Houston, and then I don't, and then sure enough, they win that game.
Yeah.
But I'm also curious, too, what is this going to do for Lamar Jackson's Heisman hopes?
Well, it's going to be hard. I mean, he's going to have to put up some points. At this point, though, he could throw up some junk numbers, I think.
He has to score.
I think his Heisman, yeah. I mean, I think you got to look at people like Deshaun Watson. I think you got to look at people like Deonta Foreman. Whatever. College football, not that exciting right now.
Well, NFL isn't that exciting right now.
Yeah, NFL's, I think...
Sports suck. We should just... Go
I'm just saying it's an off year because, like, there's such a stratification in talent now.
Well, no. So the NFL is kind of back to where it was in the early 90s when you had two teams trading, you know, Super Bowls all the time. What you're seeing is some contenders and a lot of pretenders and a lot of hopeless teams. I mean, I think that's the problem is when you have a hopeless team like Jacksonville, then you have these sort of, like, matchup problems. Now, you can still stack 4 or 5 NFL games on a Sunday, and people who gamble and play fantasy are going to care, but it's hard because when you get into the primetime games, it's hard to sell a game unless you have the fucking Dallas Cowboys or the New England Patriots, and that's it. Denver's a big team, Seattle's a big team, but they don't move the needle. They're not must-see TV. It's New England and Dallas.
Well, it's like, you know, right now, it's Thursday night, we're recording this, Carolina's playing New Orleans.
Great game.
Should be a great game, but New Orleans doesn't have a defense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like...
And neither team
But Carolina defense. Is... I know Carolina's going to probably win that game. And I'm from New Orleans. Like, I want New Orleans to win, but it's like Drew Brees is going to throw some amazing touchdowns. And can't... But he's not... That defense is going to betray him. So it's like there's no suspense there.
It's funny you mentioned that, because the second you said that, though, we all looked at our phones to see what the fuck the numbers look like. Not great. Not great.
Who's leading?
13-3 Carolina.
Yeah.
Well, and it's also, I mean, Thursday night football is not a great product, and you're seeing it reflected here in that the home team almost always usually covers, and I think Carolina was either a slight favorite, and now they're
3.5
up by 10.
Three and a half point favorite. They're up by 10.
Yeah.
So there you go. I guess we should talk very briefly about what happened this week, which is Tony Romo conceded the race to Dak Prescott.
He's saying hallelujah. It was a whole thing.
I just want to, what I'm going to do here, because
Dak Prescott ran a very unconventional campaign.
He said he was going to build a wall and make Cincinnati pay for it.
I'm going to send flowers to Ramon because
my best friend, whose name is Hatley Vitato, he's an obsessive Cowboys fan.
It's an awesome name.
One of my best friends, and he sent me this text message. Send me this text message, and I kind of want to read it because this sums up how I feel and how what I think is more importantly going to happen.
Uh-huh.
He wrote, here's what will happen the rest of the season with Dak. He'll lose one of the next two to either the Redskins or the Ravens. He'll lose at the Giants and to close the season at Philly, finishing 12-4. Cowboys will have the 2 seed. We'll lose to the Seahawks in the NFC Championship game. Great accomplishment for a rookie, but would have made the Super Bowl with Romo, period. That's where I'm at, unfortunately. I think that this running game that Dallas has can go literally anywhere and beat you, and that's what makes them so good. What's great about the Dallas Cowboys, people don't realize this, and I'm gonna pull up, and I made some notes here in preparation for the show, and I hope I can find them. But if you go back and you look at, like, the Dallas Cowboys and who they've drafted since 2010, so... This is a rundown of their first and second round picks since 2010. And I'm going to make the case here that Dallas has quietly been building a New England Patriots-like juggernaut roster.
Mm-hmm.
So starting with 2010, Dez Bryant, Sean Lee. 2011, Tyron Smith. 2012, Morris Claiborne. Tyrone Crawford, who plays on the defensive line, still there. 2013, Travis Frederick, starting center. Terrence Williams, starting wide receiver. J.J. Wilcox, useful nickelback. 2014, Zach Martin, starting guard. DeMarcus Lawrence, starting defensive lineman out of Boise State. Anthony Hitchens in the first round, defensive lineman. 2015, Byron Jones, starting safety for the Dallas Cowboys, one of the best young players on the team, one of the best young safeties in the NFL. Randy Gregory, who was a top 10 talent that fell to the second round. If he ever stops smoking weed, he's going to be a big fucking part of this team.
Are we talking about Ricky Williams?
Randy Gregory, who's an edge rusher out of Nebraska. This year, goes without saying, Ezekiel Elliott, Dak Prescott, Malik Collins, Jalen Smith, who might be better than all those players. He was that freakish Notre Dame linebacker who tore his ACL. They took him in the second round, and next year he's going to play. So the point is, like,
well, not to mention the in 2015 signing
Lowell Collins out of LSU.
Yeah. Yep.
So this is an absolutely this is a team that is brimming with young talent,
and they built it the right way.
That built it the right way, which is why I like rooting for them, and why I believe in Jason Garrett. Now,
and it could have all come crumbling down had somebody been able to convince Jerry Jones to draft
Johnny Manziel.
That would have fucked everything up.
So now,
even I would have been pissed if that happened.
Now, let's go back to the Romo career, and let's really look at what his career has been. Colin Cowherd called him duct tape, and that's a great way to describe him. He's been duct tape for the franchise for 10 years. In a lot of ways, masking a lot of problems, dealing with a lot of issues, making serviceable receivers out of names like Sam Hurd, Patrick Creighton, LaRon Robinson, Kevin Ogletree, whom we at one point thought was going to be okay.
Miles Austin.
2006 Tony Romo comes in. This is a team that that Bill Parcells, who coached the Cowboys from 03 to 06, was kind of building up and was drafting smartly, but it was a veteran, old, aging team. And Romo came in, ran the ship, took them to the playoffs. 2007, Wade Phillips comes in, who's a heck of a gentleman, good defensive coordinator, but kind of a player's coach, kind of a hands-off guy. The team was – that was the team that Parcells built. Cowboys won 13-3. Lost to the Giants in the playoffs because of kind of poor preparation. That was when Tony Romo went to Cabo. Was seen as this like knucklehead move. It certainly was. It's a bummer. Wasted a good 13-3 season. 2008, Cowboys go 8-8. They ended the season with a tough loss at Philly where they missed the playoffs. But Romo, that was the Romo breaks his thumb, misses like four games. Cowboys started 3-0. Season was a wash, but afterward they got rid of T.O. T.O. was the scapegoat of 2008. Mm-hmm. 2009, the Cowboys get it together. They finally slay the Donovan McNabb Eagles. They beat them consecutive weeks, win a playoff game, lose to the Brett Favre Vikings, but have a pretty good season, make the playoffs, win the playoffs. 2010 is the Romo collarbone injury.
You're like a bard of the Cowboys, man.
I'm a Cowboys fan.
I'm really impressed.
Like, I'm not making fun of you. Like, I'm just like, damn.
What I'm saying, 2010 was, again, that's when they fired Wade Phillips. That's when the Bill Parcells team got old and started to disintegrate. And that's when Tony Romo broke his collarbone five games in the season. Mm-hmm. John Kitna had to finish the year. If there's something...
How old was he at the time?
Oh,
was he 40?
God, I think he was like 55. If there's one good thing that came out of 2010, it's that Jason Garrett became the guy. Now, when the Ravens hired John Harbaugh, they'd offer the job to Jason Garrett. Jason Garrett said, no, I'm going to stick with the Cowboys. Gets the job full time at the end of 2010, takes over, hasn't looked back. He's going to be there for a long time. But 2011 to 2013 was Jason Garrett, Tony Romo, Jason Witten. We have to rebuild the Cowboys. We have a historically bad defense. We have a tackling dummy defense. We have no identity on defense. We have when I say historic, I mean giving up historic amount of yards for the Dallas Cowboys on defense. And that 2011, 2012, 2013, when you think about those seasons, you're going to think of all these unbelievable comebacks. That, you know, Tony Romo since 06 has more fourth quarter comebacks than any other quarterback in the league, and it's because 2011, 2013, that was Houdini Romo running all over the field, getting crunched in the pocket. Mm-hmm. Beating the 49ers on the road with a punctured lung and not missing a game,
But people still give him shit.
Coming back on the Saints.
He's a tough dude. He's a tough
basically playing his ass off. And 2011 ended with a loss at the Giants. 2012 ended with a loss at the Redskins. 2013 ended with a loss at the the Eagles came to Dallas and beat them. So they went for the cycle. They lost to all three divisional opponents on the last game of the season. All three times it knocked them out. All three times they lost the division to that person who beat him. So that was rough. And 2014 was when it was like, okay, we're over Romo, we're tired of this, we need to see some real progress. Well, guess what? The offensive line was starting to come together. DeMarco Murray goes off for like 1,700 rushing yards. Cowboys go 12-4. They win at the Seahawks. That was the Dez Bryant should have been a catch Green Bay Packers game.
I still remember that bullshit.
But I mean, what Romo did and what Romo did to keep the Cowboys in the game, when you say he's such a good quarterback, he's such a Houdini. What I mean by that is, if you look at the field and you're going to see, if you can break it down, if you go to sites like Blogging the Boys and you look at the charts, you're going to say, here's a little breadbasket box in the middle of the field. Okay, this is where 9 out of 10 quarterbacks are going to make the safe throw. This is the safety valve throw. This is what you've seen Dak Prescott do for 8 weeks. Here is the breadbasket throw in the middle of the field, 6 to 7 yards, high percentage, low risk throw. And here's where Tony Romo threw it, which is this crazy, wild, and unbelievably accurate back shoulder throw, or this crazy slant, and he did it in situations where you don't have to do it as a quarterback, where it's unpopular to do it as a quarterback, where a lot of front-running quarterbacks like Aaron Rodgers, Aaron Rodgers is notorious for not coming back as a Green Bay Packer, and his completion percentage gets worse as the game progresses, because in losses, Aaron Rodgers is not going to go and mess up his percentage.
He's not a gamer.
He's not going to get his dirty jersey. So like that
dirty jersey is my rap name.
I mean, he has to go meet Olivia Munn after. I mean,
well, I mean, so but like you see the Packers get more conservative when the games get tighter. So that brings us to the 8-1 Dallas Cowboys that we have right now. Dak Prescott, like Tony Romo said this week, has earned the job. Well, he's won 8 games in a row. But let's be very clear. He's put the Cowboys in some bad positions. He's made bad mistakes. He's made, you know, he's played slightly better than Trevor Siemian. We're grading him on a rookie curve. And what's frustrating is that, yeah, he's earned the job, but also what you're trying to do is win the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And
I don't think a lot of fans are.
Well,
and that's the problem.
Yeah.
See, I think the scenario should play out kind of like it did in any given Sunday. Like Dak Prescott right now is Willie Beeman. And, yeah, at some point he's going to struggle in a game and they're going to throw Tony Romo out there, and that's when it's going to click for Dak Prescott. Like, he doesn't take any chances down the field. It's really frustrating if you have Dez Bryant on your fantasy team like I do because Dak just won't throw deep to him. You need a gunslinger like Romo to sort of maybe teach that to him. And if Dak Prescott sees Tony Romo do that in a game he's struggling in, you know, maybe not in the playoffs, like maybe that's not the time to teach that lesson, but, you know, throughout the regular season, if he's struggling, throw Tony Romo in there, let him kind of see what a veteran quarterback does and how he does it.
Yeah. So I just want to point out what you guys have just witnessed in the past 4 minutes is a true fan.
Yes.
Going to bat for his team, for his man.
Mr. Ramon goes to Dallas.
I appreciate the hell out of Ramon for that.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah, so it goes another guy. I mean, I'm a Cowboys fan, but I just think, like, it is unfair to stick with the team for 10 years and finally have the contender around you in place and to not get to be the guy.
The problem is he's been the guy for...
Been the guy for a long time. You can say that he's had his chances, but I think that...
Well, see,
and he's definitely, you know, he's definitely blown a few games. He's had some iconic fails. But it is fundamentally sad that he's not going to get a chance to see this thing out, because I truly believe that with Romo, the Cowboys go to the Super Bowl, and without him, they're going to be stopped just short.
I think that he is going to start at least one more game this season.
I think at some point he gets thrown back in there.
Yeah.
Well, can I draw a comparison? And I think it's going to be a lot like Any Given Sunday, but mine's a little nerdier. A lot nerdier. it's like Mighty Ducks 2.
Okay.
When, you know, Goldberg was the hot goalie. He had the hand. Yeah. But Julie the Cat Gaffney
Tony Romo's
was better.
Julie the Cat?
Yeah. when it comes down to it, if they're in that game and Dak is just fucking up, I think they will just go, Tony, let's do this.
Yeah.
And he's gonna go in, he's gonna pump the sides of the goal. It's gonna work just like Julie the Cat Gaffney. It's gonna be good.
Well, and you know, I think the issue with that though is what the Cowboys wanna do is the last thing they wanna do is to put Dak on a short leash, and they don't wanna and put Dak in a position where holy shit, he's having a bad game, let's go to Romo.
No,
like, what they had Romo go out and do is say, guys, the Tony Romo era is over. Dak's the guy. I'm only going to play in the event of an injury or in the event of an extreme four interception game or something like that.
But if Dak is as good as a person as they think he is, what if he gives him, he does the PD thing from Remember the Titans, is like, I can play with these guys. I can't play with these guys. I can't make that throw. You got to come in, Tony.
Well, I
mean, that's what we're thinking, I know.
Yeah, but also the Cowboys are just so good right now that they don't have to worry about that. Like, they have real concerns on defense because Morris Claiborne and Barry Church are hurt, and that makes them thin in the secondary.
Mm-hmm.
But that running game. Now, here's the nightmare scenario is, okay, Zeke Elliott has some pending domestic violence issues.
Mm.
Two allegations in two states from the same young woman. He was clear on all charges of the first one, but there's a second one, and the NFL is doing its due diligence. So if the NFL has to arbitrarily suspend Zeke Elliott in December, in January...
good.
Well, yes, good. And yes, good that they're doing their due diligence, because obviously we need to know what happened, and we need to either clear this young man or suspend this young man.
Yeah.
As quickly as possible.
Sure. Here's the point in the podcast where we say domestic violence is never okay. And we have to make sure that athletes understand that they are beholden and are not above the law.
Well, my big thing would be to know under what circumstances was his other charge dismissed. Because sometimes the person that's a victim can file, I think it's a letter of non-prosecution. And a lot of that can be coerced. So I would just be wondering, what was the circumstances? Was he found out guilty, or were the charges just... never follow through on.
Yeah, he probably did it. And for those that don't know, for those that missed the story, because a lot of people missed the story at the beginning of the season, this young woman, his former girlfriend, tagged a bunch of pictures on Instagram of her bruises and then immediately made her pictures private. But she tagged Zeke Elliott on those photos. So she had like photos of her bruises that she posted and tagged Zeke Elliott and then went private. And then he denied him. He said she was trying to exploit him. He was pretty vehement in his resolve. And he was cleared. But there was a separate incident that had a police report that was a 911 call in Florida back in April. And that's what the NFL is currently investigating. So we will see, folks. We will see. But it is entirely possible that Zeke Elliott is a serial abuser. And let's hope he's not.
But it is important for him to get due process.
Due process. You got to due process.
There is a possibility that maybe he didn't do it. And I'm not apologizing for him, but it's like...
Well, I mean, you know...
There's a possibility that maybe he's telling the truth.
He's been transparent and outwardly defensive. And, you know, if nothing else, he's doing a good job of publicly lying. But I think there's pretty good reason to think that because this is a one-person thing that maybe... who knows? But I can't help but to, like, I'm always going to side with the accuser and the victim in the situation. And, you know, having seen the bruises, I mean, I don't know how you fabricate. I don't know how you necessarily fabricate a bunch of scuffs. But, you know, that's one of those things. And I just want to, you know, because while we get ready to sign off, we talked boys, we talked LSU, we talked the Cubs, we talked the Aggies, we talked Donald Trump. I guess we should not talk about Donald Trump. I feel like there's nothing else that can possibly be said.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything else.
You know, it was a bummer. But, you know, all we got to do is move forward as a country, stick together, and we'll be all right. With respect to, oh, man, though, or maybe we'll have like a little nuclear war action going down.
It's the ultimate sport.
Yeah. The fuck were we talking about? We were talking about Donald Trump.
I think we're closing down the show.
From domestic violence to closing out the show.
Right, so domestic violence. So this Zeke Elliott story, though, what does kind of bother me, it's a big fucking story. It's the biggest star in the NFL, and it's just not getting any kind of traction. For those of you who consume media, you have to be critical of the media that you consume. And it's nice to, like, read the ChicagoCubs.com story, and they hire some guy that they poached from a newspaper by saying, you know, like a friend of mine who was making like $40,000 at a newspaper. The San Antonio Spurs came in. They were like, hey, why don't you, like, ditch these losers at the San Antonio Express and come, like, write puff pieces for us. Now, you can't be critical of us, but come hang out. You can be an employee of the Spurs. You can get the scoop when Tim Duncan retires. Well, just come hang out. It's a better deal. Now, you can't be critical. We may delete some posts that we don't like, but it'll be great. You get to travel with the team.
I mean, I don't see something. I mean, I don't know if that's...
So, oh, it's a bullshit job. It's a PR job.
But yeah, just don't call yourself a journalist. You're not PR, which is fine.
Right. The point
is better.
That, like, yeah, like, you're never, you know, so don't be the fan who only reads, like, DallasCowboys.com.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Don't be that guy. With respect to President-elect Donald Trump, all we got to do is hang in there. What's up?
A really good site, just if you want, like, if you're looking for stats and, like, unbiased, you know, not necessarily news or puff pieces, but just, like, unbiased stats that back up a lot of what you were saying as far as Tony Romo being a better quarterback. Pro Football Focus. They run a lot of analytical models, come up with different types of numbers. They grade offensive linemen. If you're wondering who's a good offensive lineman, I think that's a really hard thing to quantify. Mm-hmm. They figured it out.
Well, and you know, both of y'all have great points, and I want to echo, because one of the things that's a problem when you do keep your news or what you read about something you like to this like little bubble that just reinforces what you want to hear, you are no longer ready for reality and what the world's putting out there. And that gets burned out over and over again because you got the Democrats thinking, well, of course.
It creates a scenario where reality slaps you in the face pretty hard.
And it's like, of course the Midwest is going to vote for us. No, you should have been listening to them. And it's the same thing like it was 2011 when the Solicitor General was arguing the Supreme Court case for health care in front of the Supreme Court. There was this really stupid conservative argument that he should have been ready for. But because he was just like, he thought, oh, they could never believe that. Of course the government can do this. He wasn't ready for it. And the stupid argument was, well, can the government make you buy broccoli? And the counter argument is, well, will everybody have to buy broccoli in their lives? Well, yes, they should be able to make you buy broccoli and to regulate it. But he didn't prepare. So it's like anybody who's like, I'm going to just read the positive LSU stuff. I'm going to read the positive thing that I like. Reality is going to slap you in the fucking face and you're not going to be ready for it. And that shit's going to hurt.
Man.
Like, it happened to me on Wednesday morning because I didn't see that shit coming.
Oh, man. I tell man, you what.
We've been all over the place on this podcast today. But I love that. I love doing this.
I want to end on a positive note. So this week, over the weekend, we wrote a story at the Daily Dot. It was called Against Mike Rowe's Folksy Facebook Rants. For those that don't know, Mike Rowe is he was the host of Dirty Jobs for 8 Season. And he's become kind of like this, like, plain-spoken philosopher who writes on Facebook. And a lot of people trust him because he's, like, masculine and cool and, like, you know, touts sort of, like, rural values. He's the everyman.
He's the every white man.
No, but, again, I want to end on a happy note. So we wrote this thing that was basically like, you know what, Mike Rowe, dude, seriously, I think you're kind of full of it right now. It was basically the crux of our argument. But to his credit, Mike Rowe posted that story on his Facebook and did like a point-by-point breakdown of what he thought. And it was incredibly civil, incredibly smart, and it just shows that there's room on Facebook specifically for some civil back and forth when we disagree. And on that note, folks, we'll see you out there. Follow us on Twitter at ITLcast. Rate us on iTunes. Give us 10 stars. Find all 120 stars in Mario 64 and send us a screen grab.
Should only have 119.
Go to www.xhamster.com and tell us what your favorite porno is.
Dude, if we get fucking tweets about that, that would be hilarious.
Hit us up at
make a playlist for us.
make a sweet
JC, I'm glad you're running the Twitter
playlist account. For us. Put out an album, make it a title exclusive. upon its release, and tell us what beer you like the most, your beer of the week. And then lastly,
I'm a fan of Hans Pilsner right now.
Shiner was good today.
Yeah.
Go download the Spotify app from the iTunes store and just enjoy some good tunes. And we'll see you guys next week or the week after or if not. And if we can't get on the same page between now and then, have a happy, healthy, safe Thanksgiving. Don't drink and drive. Tip your bartenders. And, Elliot, go in.
And just good luck getting, if you got a family that you can't stand, just
Should we do a little table
bite
manners?
Your tongue.
What is it, a segment called Table Manners?
Yeah, just bite your tongue and get through it.
We almost finished. We almost finished. It's okay. All right. It's all right. This is good. It's good.
So we're like Lord of the Rings. We got several different endings.
No, I actually had an idea. If you ran Logan Urie University, here's another segment. Okay, Logan, tell me the commercial for Logan Urie University. Because you know how, like, when you're watching college football, there's always these commercials?
Yeah.
And it's always like, here's a black kid in a laboratory. Be the best.
Oh, Alabama's diverse.
Alabama's diverse.
Shit.
I had a friend named TJ Finley who graduated from Duke Law School, and they used a picture of him graduating from Duke Law School like 3 years in a row on their like commencement homepage.
That happened to me. Yeah. Like, I went to UT, and like they used my picture in three different spots in the same pamphlet.
They're like, oh,
like this, of doing different things, and they're like, oh, this is Elliot. This is Elliot. Well, I'm like, am I like a Trump card? And it's like, he applies to all races. We don't know what he is. So
we'll call it the Logan Urie School of Audio Engineering for Podcasts.
Are you guys just trying to say that I'm too white?
Get your horns up.
I would not have horns up on my
get your bachelor's
university.
What would be your mascot?
The Fightin' Irish, I guess.
The last allowed racist mascot. Yeah.
We'd be the Fightin' Spaniels. It'd be a bunch of cute dogs.
It'd just be Penny.
And here come the Fightin' Spaniels. And there's just like a couple dogs running down the field. All right.
It'd probably be Corgis, though.
The Corgis. New, a little Inside the Locker Fantasy Football League update. Logan, what place?
JC's in the lead.
JC, what place are you in?
Second.
What's your record?
No, you're number one right now.
Oh, am I?
Yeah.
It's like, I think I've lost two or three games. Okay, so I'm playing you right now.
I'm playing you right now? Yeah. Damn, okay.
You smoked me last week.
Well.
That's right.
It's all right. I just got you on that week, bro. Sometimes Kobe drops 40. Sometimes Shaq drops 40.
Well, I had one week where I got 160 and somebody beat me by 2 points.
Damn.
And I was like, you motherfuckers.
So Logan and Elliot are out of it.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of people
I'm currently 5-5.
5-5 right here.
Not bad. I'm 7-3, so I'm like in fourth or third place. So I'm in the playoff picture. JC is like 8-2 or 7-3, also in the playoff picture. And he and I are playing this weekend. So best of luck to you this weekend.
Oh, wait. No.
No.
Sorry. Blake Salisbury.
Salisbury's little brother, friend of the pod.
He's 9-1.
9-1.
Is it bad form for me to just trade away all my good players to want somebody in the lead? Just be Kingmaker?
Yes,
that'd be cool. Yeah.
I want to do that so bad.
Kingmaker Fontenet.
I really do, just to fuck with people. Be like, that's not fair. Why? I'm just not interested in winning. I want this person to win.
It's against...
What rule?
There's no rules. It's just...
I'll allow it.
It's like, I would give them all. I would split them between JC and Ramon.
What about me, man? You don't have a chance. If we combine our resources, then we can take this thing, man.
Who wants Gronk? Listen,
we can take this thing,
like,
man.
Who wants Cam Newton? Who wants Marcus Mariota?
Yeah, let me get all those dudes. all right, so table manners, new segment I just made up. So you're going home for Thanksgiving, and you're sitting next to old Uncle Racist, and he's in there making jokes about Michelle Obama. What do you do? And I think my answer is, you know what, Uncle Racist, it's cool, man. You know, we're good. We can agree to disagree. Please pass the yams.
So, okay, as the whitest dude at the table, you have to be careful about always calling someone racist just because they are not.
That's important.
Just because they voted for Trump.
That's important.
They may not be racist, but they are okay with racist.
Yes, and that is extremely problematic. But, like, so this is something that we've been discussing quite a bit. That you have to... It's very important to not talk down to folks who don't agree with you, because once you do that, then they start dismissing every single thing that you say. If you try to start a conversation and try to at least understand their perspective, then I think that it's extremely important, and it also makes them want to understand your perspective as well.
I actually like how... And I know comedians sometimes aren't the best people to cite when it comes to looking for rationales and things like that. And especially this comedian that I'm about to reference, He's one of the most contentious and offensive comics out there. But Jim Jeffries, I think, summed it up really nicely when he talked about Trump, where, you know, he mentioned, he's like, if you've got someone in your life who is an asshole to you, only thing you could do is to treat that person with love. Now, he may not ever love you. In fact, he'll probably continue to hate you for the rest of his life. But if you only come at him with love, eventually other people will see him as the asshole.
Yeah, I actually had just this week. I had I posted this story. Just it was basically it was a post from a conservative who did not agree with Trump, but also it was basically just trying to explain perspective from that. And a liberal friend of mine agreed with that, and then a friend of theirs who did not who did not read the article, but who I did not know, started posting terrible stuff on there, and I made the effort. I was like, okay, well, the one thing in particular said that, like, the country is more divisive than ever, and that's only because of Obama. And I was like,
stupid shit.
Please explain to me why Obama particularly has made you has made your life worse. But the point was, like, once I started asking questions, at least I tried to start asking questions in a sense that it was, like, respectful. I didn't agree with it. I was a little bit angry at the time, but I once I started, like, engaging them like a human being instead of, like, having a bitch fight about it, it turned into a conversation, and we were able to, like, try to get to the root of the problem. It seemed like a lot of it was a distrust in media.
No. You're giving him too much credit. If you say that Obama has led to the most divisive. One, you don't know history.
Sure.
Let me finish. You don't know about the nadir of race relations, so I'm sorry. I don't have to come and act like you're not ignorant when I'm talking to you. And I don't have to excuse your ignorance. I don't have to excuse people who fucking hate me, okay? Who think I am not as smart as them because of the color of my skin. People who believe the fucking bell curve. I don't have to understand their little fucking foibles. They don't need to be understood. They need to be beat. They need to lose this debate. This is a fight to win, not a fight to understand. So if somebody comes to me and says, well, you know, I think Obama's made things more divisive. All I'm hearing is that he threatened your white privilege. Okay.
Yeah. Well, so, I kind of felt like you did on Wednesday. But now I think that, you know, we just have to get through this together, and we just have to kind of, like, be good to each other, and that means, you know, sort of like ignoring a lot of things that fundamentally clash, you know.
I wouldn't say ignoring, but I'd say excusing,
making
passing,
excuses for.
I think it's ignoring. I think you just have to say, we're not going to agree on a few things, and all we got to do is just kind of be cordial, be civil, get through it. You know, I got into there's a commentator named Clay Travis who tweeted something about the election, and it was, like, very kind of dismissive and distant. And I kind of hit him up, and I was like, you know, I admire your ability to be kind of, like, cool and detached when, like, the guy that the KKK endorsed is the president. And, like, I got a couple of people on Twitter sort of follow up with me about that. And I went back and forth with the guy for a little bit, and then I was like, hey, man. We're going to have to agree to disagree. I looked at his profile. I could tell he'd been in the service. He had two kids. I said, we're going to have to agree to disagree. Thanks for your service, and have a great evening. And that was kind of that. And then the guy just kind of liked my comment, and that was that.
I agree. Sorry.
I was going to say, so it gets hard when we deal with things that are blatantly racist.
That's
and kind of like
we have to, like,
bubble
act
at that.
Like it isn't.
Well, it is,
but what I'm saying is, if you have to deal with that, I think a better thing than trying to treat it like it's not is just not to engage. Because it's like, if you're going to come at me as your first opening salvo that Obama is the most divisive, I no longer have to listen to you as a valid opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You are no longer anybody I want to convince, because I'm not going to be able to convince you. All that's going to happen is I'm going to spin my wheels for 2 hours,
right?
And we're going to be like, I agree to disagree, because you're not even. Now, if you come to me and you said, well, I voted for Trump because I think he'll bring back the jobs and some real reasons, I can talk to you.
Sure.
But if you're coming here and saying, well, I want him, and all these immigrants are, you know, Obama's divisive, or, man, Michelle Obama's not a right first lady, or Obama hasn't done anything, you don't get to talk to me. You don't get, You don't get to me look at you valid.
So I'm going to interrupt here, and I think that this actually comes into play where white privilege is important, because I was able to respond back, and I think not change his mind, but at least kind of keep him open to understanding things, because I am white.
No,
and I think that is important.
No, and I agree, but it's something that, you know, that the sentiment, and I don't think y'all are putting it forward, but it's something I've heard a lot.
Sure.
And I heard it a lot when I was in law school.
Yeah.
There's this sentiment that minorities who are getting advanced degrees, one of your values is you can teach white people not to be racist.
Mm.
And that bothers the fuck out of me, because I am the aggrieved party. Like, why is it my responsibility to tell you when you're fucking up? Like, I went to this thing one time where they were being extremely racist.
Comic-Con.
No, and I don't want to say, because it actually happened 10 years ago, and I almost got sued off of this bullshit.
What was it?
But they were like, you should have told us, as the only black person there, that we were being racist.
Well,
why is it on me? Like, what I want to do is to keep myself safe. It's like, I tell you this, I do work where I try to help rural people. It's part of my job. But I am still fucking afraid to drive through East Texas.
It's because people are fucking idiots. That's the thing. And, like, people have very little perception of others outside of themselves. Maybe their family. And it's like, for a large percentage of the population, empathy is very difficult.
And I agree. But what I'm saying is, if you're, it's like saying, this population, their biggest concern is how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't fair, and I'm going to lose my job. I'm being asked, as somebody who's legitimately afraid I might get killed, to understand them.
But it's also, like,
why should I? No. You don't. I have to understand you.
Yeah.
Because 80 years ago, you tried to take my grandfather's farm away. 40 years ago, you locked my dad up for protesting. I don't got to understand you. And that's one of the great things. That is one of the great things. One of the things I really like about hanging around my family. Because we don't have mixed perspectives. Man, Trump's a fucker. Yep. And we move on.
But at the same time, why should they care? Why should they give a fuck about you? Yeah, which I disagree with.
I agree. I start off with the premise that they don't give a fuck about me.
Yeah.
And so I say, fuck you right back. So, and I try to do
what I can. The point that I'm trying to make is that you have to teach empathy. That's what you have to teach. You don't have to teach that things are terrible. You have to teach that, hey, you should be paying attention to how other people feel, because that's important for culture, for society.
No, and I agree. I'm objecting to these think pieces that I've been reading like the last week. It's like, we need to understand their plight. I'm like, you know, let's talk to people who live in rural Louisiana.
Yeah.
Who, like, you know, can't get jobs except to work on an oil rig, but Louisiana can't keep that tax money. So Louisiana has one of the worst public school systems in the nation.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm sorry, I happen to not care about the Midwest. I care about Louisiana.
Yeah.
I care about Texas, because that's the way our system works. Sorry, I'm just...
Well,
sorry.
We didn't really... So again, the segment here is table manners.
And I exhibited none of them. So don't do what I did.
But, you know, luckily, Elliot doesn't really have to deal with this. But, like...
Yeah, I don't.
You know, my wife's grandfather... who's a young man, it's in his early 70s, great guy, single-issue voter, but also kind of a racist dick, and I don't have a choice but to be nice to him.
Mm.
And so I think what we have to do in those situations is, you know, what you have to understand about people is that people love the individual and they hate the class.
Yeah.
And so you're one of the nice ones, you're one of the friendly ones. All you can really do... is just go, be polite.
You're a credit to your race, Elliot.
Have some casserole, say thanks, have a great evening, and then that's it. And then just kind of move on and not let it roll off your back. And you have to do it. You have to be thick-skinned. You have to be patient. You have to be smart. You have to be respectful. We got to live together. And in 4 years, we'll see what happens. Although, I'll tell you what, in 4 years, I think Trump's going to win even bigger.
Oh.
Because he's going to have 4 years of fame. That dude is so famous. Democrats don't have anyone on the bench who's a serious contender.
They really don't.
You got 8 years of Trump coming, unless he gets bored or gets impeached. And folks, on that hopeful tone,
Jesus Christ.
Stay inside the locker, and we'll see you on the other side. Don't forget to go to iTunes, give us a five-star review, subscribe to the pod, tip your bartender. with the holiday season coming up, just remember, don't drink and drive. Don't grope the receptionist at your holiday party. I know you want to, Bob. I know you want to. Don't do it.